In the previous session, we looked at the figure of woman wisdom in the book of Proverbs, and we saw that that while she represents the personification of Yahweh's wisdom, the fact that her house is on the highest point of the city indicates that she actually stands for Yahweh himself, because, of course, the only house that could be built on the highest point of the city would be the temple. And yes, Woman Folly's house is also on the highest point of the city, and she represents the false gods and goddesses that are trying to lure Israel away from the worship of the true God. So it's another way that Proverbs uses to underline the fact that that it's the fear of the Lord, which is the beginning of wisdom. You have to have a relationship with woman wisdom in order to be considered wise, according to the book of Proverbs. Now, you might ask, by the way, before we turn our attention fully to the New Testament, why is wisdom personified as a woman in the book of Proverbs? And again, we're speculating a bit here, but I think it's more than simply the fact that the word for wisdom in Hebrew is feminine, chokmah. I think it might also extend to the fact that, in traditional societies and in the Bible, women are associated with the quality of wisdom. It's not that men aren't wise. I mean, in his early life, Solomon's the epitome of wisdom, but we learn about the wise woman of Tekoa, etc. So maybe wisdom was a quality that was associated with women. Certainly, later in the course, we'll see that the metaphor of God as a mother, which is associated with the quality of God's compassion and mercy, is related to women. Indeed, the Hebrew word for compassion is also the Hebrew word for the womb. And of course, the womb is associated with women, not men. But I would submit to you that there's probably a third reason, and that is that as you look to Egyptian literature, you find a lot of similar writings to the book of Proverbs. You have an extensive instructional literature where there are a lot of Proverbs. And we know that Israelite sages were familiar with Egyptian wisdom. There are a couple of reasons why we know that. One is that there's some similarities between some of the biblical Proverbs and Egyptian Proverbs. You might ask, well, how could that be if the beginning of wisdom is the fear of the Lord, because those Egyptian sages didn't fear the Lord. That said, it's clear that Israelite sages respected Egyptian wisdom. I think they would say that all truth is God's truth, and that the Egyptians kind of stumbled across some practical advice based on their experience that was helpful, and they adapted it to the Hebrew situation. And then they'd still turn around and say, well, that Egyptian wise man isn't truly and clearly wise because they don't fear the right God. And again, this is all supported by a reference in 1 Kings 4, where Solomon's wisdom is being assessed very positively. And notice how the author of Kings compliments Solomon's wisdom. It says in verse 30, Solomon's wisdom was greater than the wisdom of all the men of the East and greater than all the wisdom of Egypt. Now, the East here is probably Edom, which had a reputation for wisdom. But notice, Solomon's wisdom is greater than the wisdom of Egypt. Now, for that to be a compliment, the wisdom of Egypt has to be pretty special, you know. His is greater than theirs, to be sure, but that means theirs is pretty good. So they had some good practical advice that instructed Israel. And so, as you read these Egyptian instructional texts, there's a concept at the center of it called Ma'at. Ma'at. If you want to spell it, it's M-A apostrophe A-T. And Ma'at is a very similar concept to Chokmah or wisdom in the book of Proverbs. It's kind of like justice and harmony and the way the cosmos fits together. But Ma'at was also personified as a woman. And so I think that Chokmah is being personified as a woman is kind of a challenge to the Egyptian idea that Ma'at is the central concept. Well, be that as it may, we can't be sure. What I'm interested in now is to turn our attention to the New Testament. And first of all, in a general sense, just emphasize the fact that Jesus is considered the epitome of God's wisdom. Jesus is the epitome of God's wisdom. He is the ultimate sage. We've often talked about Jesus being the ultimate priest, the ultimate prophet, the ultimate king. Well, he's also the ultimate wise man. The emphasis on this begins in the infancy narratives in Luke chapter 2. We don't learn a lot about Jesus when he's growing up, but we do learn that he's wise. Look at Luke chapter 2, verse 40, which says, "And the child grew and became strong. He was filled with wisdom, and the grace of God was upon him." And that is repeated in verse 52. "And Jesus grew in wisdom and stature and in favor with God and men." And the story in between those two verses is the one story that we learn about Jesus as a young man. It's kind of the left behind story or left alone story, home alone story of the New Testament, when Jesus gets taken by his parents to the temple, and then they leave and they're on their way home. They go, "Where's Jesus?" And they go back to the temple. And what did they discover? They discover young Jesus in conversation with the leading rabbis of the day and confounding these teachers with his wisdom. When Jesus actually starts preaching, you'll remember the reaction to his preaching. The people say, "He teaches like no one has ever taught before." He overwhelms them with his wisdom. The other thing to consider as we're reflecting on the Gospels is that Jesus's primary vehicle for teaching the people is the parable. Jesus is somebody who teaches using parables. Now, something you may not know is that the Greek word for parable, which is easy to memorize because it's parabole, is its Hebrew equivalent is mashal, M-A-S-H-A-L. And mashal is the Hebrew word for proverb. And so the point being that as the New Testament talks about Jesus going around teaching in parables, it's essentially saying that Jesus is a sage who's teaching in Proverbs. Now we turn our attention to Paul. And of course, Paul also emphasizes the wisdom of Christ. Well, let's take a look at a couple of passages. First of all, in the opening chapters of 1 Corinthians, where we read this, it goes, "For the message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it's the power of God. For it's written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, the intelligence of the intelligent I will frustrate. Where is the wise man? Where is the scholar? Where is the philosopher of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God, the world through its wisdom did not know him, God was pleased through the foolishness of what was preached to save those who believe. Jews demand miraculous signs and Greeks look for wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and foolishness to Gentiles. But to those whom God has called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ is the power of God and the wisdom of God. For the foolishness of God is wiser than man's wisdom, and the weakness of God is stronger than man's strength." And the passage goes on, but let me underline verse 20. Christ, the power of God, and the wisdom of God. And then a second passage in Paul's letter to the Colossians, chapter 2, verse 3, where Paul talks about Christ, in whom are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. Again, Christ is the epitome of God's wisdom. He is the ultimate sage. But more important for our study of woman wisdom is the fact that there are a handful of passages which associate Jesus with woman wisdom. Associate Jesus with woman wisdom. Let's start with Matthew chapter 11. Now, the context here is that Jesus is in a debate with Jewish leaders who are upset because he is essentially partying, you know, with certain people, and he brings to their attention the fact that they also were upset with John the Baptist because he led an ascetic lifestyle. But what I'm particularly interested in is how Jesus ends his debate with them. In verse 19, he tells them, "But wisdom is proved right by her actions." Wisdom is proved right by her actions. So in this sentence, he's associating himself with none other than woman wisdom. And he's saying, I will be proved right by my actions. But he says it by saying wisdom will be proved right by her actions. A little bit more explicit or extended is Colossians chapter 1, verse 15 and following. So we're back in Colossians. And here, Paul describes Jesus as the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. Remember, woman wisdom was described as the firstborn over all creation. And he goes, "For by him all things were created, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or powers or rulers or authorities." And now, this is why I wanted you to make a mental note of verses 15 and 16 of Proverbs 8, woman wisdom's special relationship with rulers and authorities. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. So in this first part of what may be an early Christian hymn that Paul is quoting, Christ is being described in language derived from Proverbs chapter 8. Now, turning to John 1, the prologue to John, and this is often, and of course rightly, connected to Genesis chapter 1 because it begins in the beginning, but then notice how here too the language echoes the language of Proverbs chapter 8, when it says, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Through Him all things were made. Without Him nothing was made that has been made. In Him was life, and that life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, but the darkness has not understood it." Okay, so John scholars like Ben Witherington and Don Carson will talk about how this language echoes Proverbs chapter 8. One final connection between Jesus and woman wisdom is found in Revelation chapter 3, verse 14. In the first line, to the angel of the church in Laodicea write, "These are the words of the Amen, the faithful and true witness, the ruler of God's creation." Now, this needs a little bit of explanation. It's in this phrase, "the ruler of God's creation," that were to see an allusion back to Proverbs chapter 8 and a connection between woman wisdom and Jesus. Here, the author of Revelation is citing the Septuagint of Proverbs chapter 8, verse 30, which I think the NIV translates, "I was constantly at his side," whereas I would translate, "I was the workman or architect at his side." It's a rare word, amon, in Proverbs chapter 8, verse 30. In the Septuagint, it's translated archon, which is well represented by the ruler of God's creation. So we could debate over the exact translation of this rare word in Proverbs chapter 8, verse 30, but there's no question that Revelation chapter 3 is citing this verse and is making a connection between Jesus and woman wisdom. So in these four or five places in the New Testament, we see that the New Testament associates Jesus with woman wisdom. Well, what does that mean, first of all, in terms of how do we then biblical theologically as Christians read Proverbs 8 and 9. Well, when we think of the decision between woman wisdom and woman folly that's presented to the reader of Proverbs, the New Testament gives us reason to understand that this is a choice between entering into a relationship with Jesus, with God through Jesus, who is associated with woman wisdom, or by choosing to make some other idol, and of course to us, Marduk and Ishtar aren't temptations, but an idol is anything that we treat as the most important thing in our life. It could be work, it could be a person, whatever, but anything other than Christ would be an idol. So when we read the book of Proverbs as a Christian, we could think of woman wisdom as pointing to Christ. And when we preach or teach from the book of Proverbs too, we should keep this in mind, that that as we talk about wisdom in the book of Proverbs, we're ultimately talking about a relationship with Jesus and following and listening and obeying Jesus. But to conclude here, let me just interject a word of caution. I've been using the term associate rather than identify. The New Testament doesn't identify woman wisdom as Jesus. Proverbs chapter 8 and 9, the picture of woman wisdom in the book of Proverbs is not a prophecy of Jesus. It's not correct to say woman wisdom is Jesus. Woman wisdom is a poetic personification of Yahweh's wisdom, ultimately standing for Yahweh himself, but it's a poem. We should not press this language literally. If we do, if we press the language literally and identify Jesus with woman wisdom, then we'll end up committing what is called the Arian error. That is, treating Jesus literally as the firstborn of creation, and therefore not the eternally begotten second person of the Trinity. And it brings us into conflict with other passages concerning Jesus when we do that. In other words, in the modern age, if you identify Jesus with woman wisdom and treat the language literally, you'll end up joining, you know, Jehovah Witness rather than, you know, Orthodox Protestant or Catholic church. So again, it's interesting and important, but also we have to be careful how we read the figure of woman wisdom in a biblical theological fashion. But here are a few thoughts to think about in terms of yet another rich metaphor of our relationship with God. Our relationship with God is like the relationship of students to a woman whose name is wisdom and who teaches us God's way.